state of California says I have to have permission. So
I see.
So go ahead and begin. Tell me a little bit about yourself and what's on your mind.
Well, I'm 25 years old, and like a couple of years ago, I was quite heavy into psychology, and this was the time when I came across the Jordan Peterson video where he was kind of surrounded by, where he was asked what he thinks about the Nazis, and he said, "Well, I don't like Nazis." And I saw in the description that he's a psychology professor, and I kind of took interest, and I found his channel. It was, you know, the brief time before he went famous, and before he went his, he made his videos about the university and stuff. And he had already his lectures recorded, where he made them on an iPad. So I've seen them, and I quite like them. At that time, when I was quite heavy into psychology, I was actually attending a psychology group, a therapy group. I liked it, but I was really bothered by the psychologist kind of having no values whatsoever. And the Peterson kind of solved that problem for me, because he was kind of calling out, like one thing I remember, like being quite amazed by, he was like saying, "Well, if you are weak and pathetic, then there is nothing good about it, and there's nothing excusable about it." And that was very unusual for a psychologist, I thought.
So did you associate psychologists with being weak and pathetic?
Not so much, but they were like tipping their toes around it, and they would kind of have this mentality where, well, let's talk about it.
Okay.
But he was kind of going, also he was mentioning Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn, and Solzhenitsyn I found like, well, who the hell does that? And that's kind of, that was unusual. Right. So I've seen some of those conversations you had, and a lot of people who went Orthodox, let's say, they had kind of an American background that was more like evangelical and stuff.
Yeah.
And I, not the case for me at all, because I grew up in Russia and my family was not religious at all. And, well, you know, it's kind of like how Christopher Hitchens wanted people to get raised, I guess. I was totally secular and I was surrounded by secular friends, no religion at all. But the funny thing is, kind of typical for, I guess, my, you know, people in Russia, I was Christian when I was a baby. So strictly technically, I'm an Orthodox Christian because I didn't have a choice.
Yeah, that's right.
I was Christian as an infant. And, you know, this is kind of where my gripe with the Russian Orthodox Church begins, because it is very heavy into rituals. So a lot of the, you know, reasons why people go to church in Russia is, well, first of all, to christen their baby, which is, why do they do that? Why do they feel like they have to do that? Mm-hmm. So not Christians in everyday life, like at all, there's just no Christian worldview, you know, heavily implanted into, you know, their everyday experience. But they have a baby and they drag that baby to the church and they christen it.
And why do you think they do that? There must be a reason. They might not be able to tell you the reason, but there must be a reason or they wouldn't be doing it.
Well, I know why my mother did it, for example.
Why?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, I guess it's kind of, well, the rituals are kind of attractive. I don't know. So it's kind of like something, a little something that you do to kind of show, I don't know, some connection to goodness, I guess. if you want to be abstract about it. But, you know, my mother couldn't give me a comprehensive answer. It was like, well, I have a little bit of faith, so, you know, I have a little bit of faith in God anyway. Not that Bible, nothing like this, but, you know. They did that.
Now, your mother, when your mother, I'll assume your mother was born during the Cold War, so during the communist era, correct?
Yeah.
Was she christened?
No, I don't think so.
So, in other words, this is something that people picked up again after the Cold War.
Well, yeah, and, well, this is kind of my problem, too, because it felt more like a fashion, you know.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I'm just asking because, you know, I was baptized, and I baptized my children, and my father was baptized, but we didn't have a communist government here standing in the way. So it's just interesting to me that your mother, who wasn't christened, then christened you, and so So it's just interesting. Okay, so what's going on with that? It's a very interesting question that you bring up. Now, I don't have the answer, but it's a very interesting question.
Sure. Well, I guess, you know, in the 90s, after the Soviet Union died, the Russian Orthodox Church kind of started spreading, reclaiming the territory again. And, you know, the local church, to me, was located in a concert hall of a musical school for children.
Really?
So I went to that school, and when I was there, you know, it was kind of weird. One of my classes located, you know, in a hallway, and on one side of a hallway, I knew there was a church, and people were acting very strange there. Like, it was a very uncanny feeling. But yeah, they were located there, and I was Christian there. But like I said, it felt for my parents and for their generation, it was more like, I don't know, felt like a fashion because it wasn't very demanding on you. You just get your baby there and it gets Christianed, and there's kind of no effort in that. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I don't like, I guess, about Russian Orthodox. Well, I don't know if I can, you know, put that, you know, grudge against the church specifically, because not really responsible for what people do. And in fact, my mother said that when she brought me as a baby there, the Pope, we call them, you know, popes. Actually, it's just funny. He was, you know, he had no qualms about showing his anger because he was like, why are you dragging these babies here?
Really?
Well, you know, it's not typical, but that one, he was, kind of angry because he didn't, you know, really, I guess, like the idea that people are coming without faith and just kind of doing it as a ritual.
Yeah.
But not everybody's like that. And I think... you know, he was kind of going against the official position of the church, because I think, well, they kind of welcome just about anyone in there.
Yeah.
The more people, the better. But yeah, also my grandmother. Hold on, I'll take a sip. When she wants, when my grandmother goes to church, she goes there to kind of plant a candle, look at the icons, I guess, and, you know, just pray for something when something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. Kind of that mentality, too. Mm-hmm. To come back to Peterson, I guess I kind of would like to have a little bit more Christianity into my life. And the way I've seen the Americans' relations with the church, where they kind of, you know, go there in the Sunday and they kind of have a little community there. That seems to be, you know, very attractive to me, but I'm not sure I can get that in the Orthodox Church. Well, the way I've seen, you know, how it is being kind of used by the people of, you know, my parents' generation and, you know, their parents' generation. Do you know anything about, I guess, what is you know, your what do you think is the difference between, you know, let's say Russian Orthodox Church and, you know, Christian Reformed Church, where I think people go on the Sunday, like I've said, and they're more interested in the stories that the preacher have to tell. Because as far as I understand, in the Reformed Church, there is, you know, no icons, no candles, a lot less rituals. Whereas in the Russian Orthodox Church, it seems they're much more heavy on the rituals rather than the stories. And I think even, you know, the way they treat Bible, they kind of pretty much say, you know, ignore the Old Testament. Yeah, it's good, it's the Bible, but, you know, just concentrate on the Jesus stuff. So don't even try to read the Old Testament because it's, you know, very, very hard for you. You'll just get confused. Just read the New Testament.
Tut, 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 go along. Leave the Bible to the professionals. You're talking, so in many ways, what you're talking about is very much along the lines of the reasons for the Protestant Reformation. The critiques that you're addressing were critiques that were given by Protestant reformers about the Roman Catholic Church in Germany and in other places in Europe, usually Northern or Western Europe, in the late Middle Ages, before the Protestant Reformation, and then afterwards. This has generally been called nominal Christianity, where you go get your baby christened. You maybe will go to church on Easter and Christmas, but for the most part, the church does the sacraments over here, and your life is over here. And so this is one of the reasons for the Protestant Reformation. And a whole set of reforms were then put in place by the Protestant reformers, who were mostly pastors of local churches. And they saw that people very much grew attached to the rituals, such as candles, such as icons. People were very attached to these things, but people were in ignorance about the Bible, and they had difficulty applying these things to their lives. This is in many ways the colonization of, one way to think about it might be the colonization of the frontal cortex of the church. Because then what happens is that the church very much becomes a something that we engage in actively, rationally, between individuals. And so the liturgy, which tended to be traditional readings from scripture, was pared down, and the homily, which is a teaching of scripture, was expanded. And what's interesting to me about talking to you about this is that, like I said, there are a lot of, Sacramento is a place for a lot of Russian and Eastern European immigration, and many of those who have emigrated to the United States to places like Sacramento have founded evangelical churches. There are 70-some evangelical churches with populations from Eastern Europe or Russia just in Sacramento. And so the critique that you've just expressed, you are by no means alone in this. Now, what's interesting is that the Jordan Peterson thing has kind of swung back. So churches in many ways, you know, took on the frontal cortex and became very cerebral, very rational, very direct. And in places like the United States, where that mode has been prevalent, there's more of a swinging back in some places to a little bit more liturgy, a little bit more ritual, a little bit more symbolism. So what we've seen over time is that the church kind of swings back and forth amongst between these poles. And I think probably often because of excesses or corruption or imbalance in either direction. So I, you know, what you just described, for example, in the Christian Reformed Church, if someone comes, and it happens, someone comes to my church and says, I want you to baptize my baby. And I'll say, I don't know who you are. I only baptize infants of members of the church. And then they look at me like, well, what do I have to do to be a member? Well, you might start by coming to church. Oh, you mean I'd actually have to come to church? Yeah, and you'd have to say that you believe the kinds of things that members say they believe. I have to do all that to baptize my baby? Yes. And then they usually find somebody else who will do it. But what you just described in a nutshell is behind the Protestant Reformation.
Well, yeah, I understand that. But I'm kind of thinking, like, for myself, if I want, because, you know, I'm thinking here, maybe I should, you know, live it like this, kind of go to the therapy meetings, which are, you know, kind of replace, I guess, the church in a way, because you come there and there's a group of people that, you know, you kind of get intimate with them, know their, you know their struggles. It's just, you know, the framework that I don't like in the therapy groups, that there is kind of no values. And that makes it tough. We have some, you know, Reformed churches here, I guess. But the problem is they might be, you know, cults. Because with the Russian Orthodox Church, at least you know kind of what you're getting into. At least you know that this is certified. And
well, and I, again, you're, so let's look at the therapy group. What will a therapy group do for you? Now, what your critique of the therapy group makes a lot of sense, because if you imagine these groups have purposes, if you go to a, you're a gem. This conversation is really good, because all of the stuff that I talk about over here with the Jordan Peterson stuff, all the stuff you're reacting to, I'm very familiar with, because that's the whole other side of the story that often doesn't come up. But if you go, many therapists that you go to, just like you described, the goal of that therapist is, do you feel better? Do you, and what that means often is, do you feel better about yourself? And when you talk about failing to address values, well, you're right there. I don't know if in the 90s there was a television show in the United States called The Sopranos.
No, I didn't see it.
Okay, yeah, I wouldn't imagine. But it was a show about a, do you know what the mafia is?
No, of course.
Okay. Well, Russians have their own versions, I'm sure. I won't go into that. But so you had this Italian mafioso who was living in New Jersey, where I grew up, so it was delightful for me because it was all very familiar places. But he was an Italian mafioso who was having panic attacks, and so he started going to a therapist. And the job of the therapist was to help him with his panic attacks, help him feel better about himself so he could continue to be a mob boss, killing people, organizing prostitution, corruption. And so part of the show was this therapist's crisis over her profession, that it's my job to help this mob boss feel better about himself when he should really be feeling guilty about the life he's leading. So right there in that show, I won't tell you to go out and get a bootleg copy of The Sopranos, but you might be interested in it. I'm sure it can be had in Russia someplace. But the whole tension of that show was over this very issue that you've just talked about. Because, okay, you go to a therapy group, and, well, the interesting conversations help me feel better. So then you have to ask yourself, why? What is church for? That's really the question you have to ask. What is
church? Well, this is what I'm trying to kind of you know, piece together for myself, I guess. Because when I see around, like, at my grandmother and my mother, it seems like church is there to kind of, you know, be a place like of, you know, kind of coming to and experiencing this, you know, beautiful feelings, like, you know, Russian churches are beautiful, generally speaking. And the atmosphere, well, it's unusual for the kind of modern life. Yeah, but you come there and the building is beautiful and it's all lit with candles. And, you know, you can kind of stand there and kind of think about life and what's important. So I'm not saying that it's entirely valueless, but kind of seems to be a little bit too individualistic for my taste, because you kind of come there and you're thinking about your own troubles mostly. You don't really connect to people. And also Russian churches, Jordan Peterson says that he doesn't go to church because he's afraid priests are corrupt. They don't believe this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the Russian churches, it's, you know, doubly so, because I know how some of these, you know, people end up, you know, in the church, I mean, working as a clergy. I kind of had an online friend who dropped out of university, and his parents kind of forced him into the seminary. So he was a... He was an atheist, and he was a biologist, and he was fairly cynical, but he went become like a clergyman. He started talking, you know, the talk, you know, he started speaking the language of the clergy, and it was almost seamless. And he,
yeah. Well, again, corruption, and in part of the issue with the state churches in Europe, like the Russian Orthodox Church, like the Reformed Church of the Netherlands, like certain state, you know, like the Church of England, is that the church became for some people a path of least resistance. And part of what happened to many of these churches when they came into a place like the United States, and I think this is happening to Russian Orthodox churches in the United States, is that part of it is immigrant dynamics, that some immigrants want the church from back home because it's a little piece of home, but part of it is there's right now in the United States, there's no social benefit for identifying with a church, which means, at least in many places, not in all places, but what that means is that for many people, the only people who are actually going to church really want to go to church. And there isn't that level of corruption. And so that's part of the benefit of a secular context, that there isn't a state church. But
no, I
love the point you're making. This is just delightful.
No, I can see how it can be wonderful, you know, coming to America and coming to an Orthodox church there, because, you know, people have more of a reason to kind of bond there.
That's right.
Because they're immigrants.
That's right.
And also the church kind of is isolated from the mainland corruption.
Because, that's right.
You know, money doesn't flow in the same way, and people are probably more dedicated there.
Yeah. And that happened with many different churches, with many different immigrant groups, including the Dutch Reformed, which was from my ancestry. But over time, you know, other dynamics happen. But the points you're making are points that have been made again and again and again in state churches in Europe, and part of the reason for the decline of the church in Europe. But what's interesting in Russia is that you have this big gap of the Soviet era, and now it's just fascinating that after the Soviet era, the church, you know, comes back around. But
this is interesting because, you know, before the Soviet era, most people who were believers, they were peasants, and they lived a very different life. They kind of lived more communally anyway. So they lived in a community. They knew who, you know, the head was in that community. You know, pretty much everything was decided for them in those communities. So they had a lot of, actually, you know, how do you say it? You know, they had a lot of vests, had a lot of, you know, had a lot of free time, and the life was different. They didn't have to wake up every day to go to work at the same time. You know, sometimes, well, first of all, you have to wake up when the sun rises. Otherwise, what is the point? Then, you know, in the winter, you don't really work as much. If somebody, you know, annoys you, you come and just beat their face as opposed to... And when you have some questions, you kind of ask your, you know, your local priest.
Yeah.
So, you know, people were very different back then.
Yeah.
So then the Soviet era happened. A lot of people kind of were moved to the city, and, you know, everything was, you know, everything was controlled by the Soviets, and obviously they were not preaching any of that church stuff, and they wrote God with a small letter G everywhere. And then it ended, and it seems like, you know, it seems like to me, it wasn't as shocking for the culture as you could imagine, you know, the transition. I think people didn't really have a lot of respect and admiration before and after. And it seems like the church is kind of fine with that. It doesn't really seek to, you know, reform in any way. Mm-hmm. It seems like it kind of, you know, it's fine with being archaic. Well, it mostly attracts old people who kind of, you know, have nothing to do in their life at the old age. Well, not as much, because I think in Russia, you know, with old people, after the Soviet era, I definitely experienced in my life a kind of my grandmother's generation. A lot of their child, a lot of their children, you know, after the 90s, kind of pretty much, well, a lot of them kind of died off. There's a lot of lonely old people in Russia because 90s happened. A lot of drugs, people are confused, and, you know, young men kind of, you know, some of them just died to addiction or in the criminal activities. So there's a lot of lonely old people, and those seem to be like, well, a lot of them kind of come to church, you know, because church kind of attracts people who, you know, in the modern time, who are kind of more desperate, I guess.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that, but, you know, a lot of them kind of come in the crisis moments in their life.
Well,
it seems like the church doesn't really want to go for those people who are more, you know, modern.
Well, you know, I would be very, oh boy, this is so interesting. This is so interesting. Because the contexts are so different. And the story of the church in Russia is, wow. You know, what? Talk about swings. Talk about, I mean, we haven't had that. I mean, the church in the United States has had its ups and downs, and it's currently in a downward phase because it reached its peak during, I mean, when nobody in Russia was going to church, more people in the United States were going to church, and you know, it's kind of balanced out. I don't know the rates of church attendance in Russia. You said mostly old people are going to church. How about friends your age? Do any friends your age go to church?
No.
Interesting.
Nobody. Well, I suspect if they have a baby, they will drag it to the church like so. No, for real. I'm not even kidding. It's most likely to, very likely to happen, because, you know, young girls, as they get older and when they have a baby, something, you know, happens in their brain, and they think that getting the baby to the church is a good idea, and that's how it happens.
Very.
But, Right, but I want to change the topic, I guess, a little bit.
Okay.
So the reason I was going to, you know, I was interested in psychology is because I was really kind of, not unlike Peterson, I don't know, he was kind of tortured by the idea of the Cold War, and I was kind of tortured by the idea of, you know, meaninglessness of life. Because, you know, I kind of quickly, I don't know, felt, you know, realized and really deeply felt that, you know, you can't really be rational. Because when you think kind of rationally about the life, you're starting thinking like, what I am rationally? I'm like, I'm a direct descendant of the very first living organism that happened, you know, on Earth some bazillions years ago. And there is no really any rationality behind it. It just kind of randomly happens. And it's been happening for, you know, millions of years. And if I die, well, so be it. It just ends, and it's not necessarily bad or good. And the reason the life, you know, appeared on Earth is a result of a cosmic car crash. And, you know, when you kind of think about it, I really deeply felt it, because when you frame it that way, nothing is really good or bad, because you're thinking in a cosmic scale, and just nothing matters. And for some reason, I was, you know, from the very young age, well, I deeply felt that. I suspect that it's not really because, you know, necessarily because, you know, of the reasons I've described. You know, my family is fairly troubled. You know, my father is an alcoholic, and, you know, I suspect my feelings have more to do with that than, you know, this kind of theological framework that I use. Mm-hmm. But still, I kind of discovered that, and it was kind of dawning at me. And when I kind of met Peterson, he was the first one who kind of gave me, you know, some words and some, you know, some way to describe how can you find meaning in life. Because I was trying to read Viktor Frankl, or I was kind of scorching the psychological, you know, books, the greats, for the answer of that, you know, for the answer for that question. Like, what is the meaning of life? If you look at the world and you see, you know, that it honestly is just a bunch of randomness. And you know, he was kind of the first one who kind of gave it to me. That, you know, first of all, kind of like not lying, you know, trying not to lie, you know, at all, seems to be a very meaningful thing, strangely enough. So that was one of the first things that I picked up. You know, and it strangely works. It's kind of like when you're trying to be very honest, it seems very, it feels very meaningful. And, you know, once again, when I kind of look back at my family, my father lied a lot because he was an alcoholic. And I think, you know, I picked up after him. And in my life, you know, before Peterson, I was really not noticing how, you know, avoiding and, you know, when I lied to kind of cover up my faults, I didn't even notice when I did that. And when I started noticing that, the life kind of felt a bit more meaningful. Like, I don't really suffer from the meaninglessness anymore, I guess. It's more like a struggle. Well, I'm fucking it up. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, kind of being obtuse about it anymore. But yeah, his lectures on a whole also, you know, another part of his kind of, you know, answer to the question of meaninglessness of life was that, you know, you kind of try to push yourself, you know, doing the hardest things, and that also kind of fills your life with meaning. And there's nothing rational about it. Well, maybe you can rationalize it, because you can rationalize absolutely everything. But, you know, there's kind of nothing strictly rational about it. You just feel meaningful. And, you know, Peterson once again kind of made me respect that, because, you know, kind of life is too short to kind of try to, you got to live. And, you know, if you can feel the meaning, you know, that's good enough. The practical approach, you know, he's pragmatist, as he said. So,
that was a really good summary just of the entire Jordan Peterson phenomenon. You just laid it all right out there. That was really very good. You've taken what 50 people have said to me and you just went, whoop, put it right there. That was really good. That was really good.
Well,
that's a thesis. I'm going to Australia. That's the thesis of what I'm going to say. You just said it all right there. And it's a personal testimony, which gives it power. So now it's interesting, because what you just said there in terms of your testimony and what happened with Jordan Peterson, and then you have the church over here, which is where we started talking. And basically what you in a nutshell, what you've said to me is that the church doesn't have meaning. I feel meaning because I started telling the truth. I started cleaning up my act. I started doing the right thing. And then naturally you want that to scale up into the rest of the world. You've started it on a small scale and you want meaning to connect up with the rest of the world. Is that right?
Well, yeah. That sums up very well too.
Yeah. And somehow you, not just you, but many others implicitly know that it had better scale. Because if it doesn't scale, then suddenly the meaning that you're experiencing, telling the truth, doing the right things, that then can just be a private anomaly or even merely a psychological experience. And what you really hunger for is for the entire cosmos to be meaningful.
Well, I wouldn't say it like that, actually. It's just I kind of want, you know, I want it to be more social, you know, more often, at least once a week. I don't know.
You want the church to be more social?
Well, at least in my life, okay. I don't know. Because, you know, as good as Peterson's stuff is, it's not something that I feel comfortable talking about to kind of, you know, normal people that I meet in life, because kind of requires them to watch Peterson lectures to kind of know what I'm talking about, because otherwise it kind of falls flat on their ears.
You are exactly right. You are exactly right. Which is why when I start these meetups, people come. What do they want to do when they get there? They want to meet other people. Because your friends, you're going to say, oh, listen to Jordan Peterson. Here's 50 hours of videos to watch. And your friends are going to say, I'm not going to watch 50 hours of videos. But when you get in a group of other people who have watched those same 50 hours of video, well, now you got something to talk about. Now you have the beginnings of a community.
Well, yeah. This is funny because I've been part of, you know, some gaming communities. Like, gaming communities very often kind of have their own canons. And it's very funny because sometimes they treat these canons way too seriously. And that almost always amused me. But now I kind of have this insight that, well, you know, those canons, they kind of form the community. And, you know, it's kind of fun to poke, you know, your nose socially in those canons and kind of, you know, have conversation about them. But yeah, you know, so sometimes it would be crazy, you know, something is obviously arbitrary in games because, you know, you have to go around levels killing things. And, you know, there's a lot of, arbitrary stuff. And then people, you know, who like that game, let's say, they gather around and they just, you know, talk in long passages about those arbitrary things and trying to find canonical explanation for why the stuff happens.
Well, if you listen to Jordan Peterson's conversation with Sam Harris about the meaninglessness of soccer, men chasing a little ball, Jordan Peterson would say, It isn't meaningless. It's never meaningless when you're trying to hit the mark, when you're aiming for something. And so it might seem arbitrary, everybody running around in the game trying to, you know, kill each other, shoot straight, you know, all that stuff. But Peterson is right. It isn't meaningless. That is the expression of something deep within us. I mean, why else would, you know, the, you know, act, I don't even, you know, Blizzard, trying to think who makes, you know, why would these video game makers be drawing in as much money as Hollywood Studios? That's coming from somewhere. It isn't arbitrary. And no, you're exactly right. The fact that you can get a group around that gets connected and can find community around the canon, it's not arbitrary. There's something real going on there. But now this is where what we imagine rationality to be drops off. Because
yeah, it does.
Because but if you sit back and you look at the data, you say, no, something's under there. And it's not probably, oh boy, it's not probably that. Why drag your kid and get it baptized at the Russian Orthodox Church? Why do all the old people who lost their sons to drugs and other bad things in the 90s, why do they drag themselves to the Russian Orthodox Church? It's not arbitrary. Something's happening. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily resolve it for you. But it's same thing with Peterson. You know, why is it that, and I've talked to so many people in my conversation, life was kind of there. And then Jordan Peterson, I clicked on a video by Jordan Peterson and I listened to him and it was like, wow. And I listened to another and another and another. And before you know it, I listened to Maps of Meaning 3 times and I watched all the biblical lectures. That's not nothing. Something's happening. Then the question is, okay, now we're going to take rationality and say, well, what exactly is happening here? So you're asking all the right questions.
Well, rationality has, you know, one downside that is not often talked about is that you can be logical about anything given that you have right, you know, beginning assumptions. You can't logic in abstract. You had this conversation with a math guy who liked Euclidean.
Yeah, right. Eric.
And,
yeah.
You know, all math begins with, you know, some assumptions that are kind of irrational, just kind of, they seem self-evident. And if you don't have them, you don't really have the game.
Right, right.
So the same thing goes for a lot of things in life. But, you know, the reason I don't, you know, I absolutely despise Marxism because there is very interesting history of the world that has, you know, tons of rivals. So if you want to think, you know, how did this come that we have this modern world, the world of modernity, where we kind of value freedom, you know, you have to look at the history and you have to realize that this is a result of a lot of various rivals kind of coming together and, you know, sometimes randomly and sometimes by design, you know, sometimes, you know, people spotted, you know, the patterns and described them, but a lot of it is just, you know, the movement of history. It's a little bit random. You know, predicated on, you know, what kind of rivers you have where you live. You know, if Russia had, you know, river connecting it to Italy, the world history would be very, very different than it is today. It's just the river. And, you know, Marxism, it kind of skips all of that. And it just says, well, there was an oppressed group and they were oppressing others. And, you know, that's how it goes. But it's not really like that at all. And, you know, for the most history, people didn't really think that freedom was anything, you know, valuable. It was kind of self-evident for people that people are not equal at all. And, you know, feudalism, it began not because, you know, some people came and conquered the land and claimed it as their own and just made everyone just, you pay me now. it wasn't really like that. People lived, and there were, you know, Vikings come once, raped and pillaged. Vikings came twice, raped and pillaged. And, you know, people, you know, sought around, like, can anyone protect us? And feudal said, well, we can, but you have to pay us. And this is kind of how feudalism formed. It's like you're being oppressed by feudal, let's say, but you also get a lot of protection from, you know, Vikings coming and raping your wife, let's say. And it wasn't such a bad trade. But if you're thinking like, you know, a modern SJW, I guess, you just like you skip past all of that nuance and you're just not looking at the history in all its beauty, I guess, where you kind of see how, you know, why did China not industrialize? You know, it is so fascinating because they were so much ahead of Europe back in medieval times. It's unbelievable. You know, they have beautiful big ships. They have paper money. They had, you know, it's so amazing. But oppressed and oppressors. It's like,
oh. Yeah. So what are you going to do? So you're studying psychology?
No,
that's a hobby.
No, it's more of a hobby. I'm really trying to, you know, yeah, get better at 3D character animation at the moment.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's a very specific thing.
Okay.
And yeah, this is more of a, I wouldn't even call it a hobby because for me it was kind of, you know, it is a continual existential dread that I'm kind of addressing. So it's not so much, you know, that it is a hobby, but it's more like, you know, it kind of dreads on me. I don't really have a choice. I have to address it somehow.
So what are you going to do with it? Now you're frustrated with the Russian Orthodox Church. You're worried about the Reformed or the Protestant churches being scammers, which is a valid concern. Don't get me wrong. Speaking as one Protestant minister, I know there's bunches of scammers out there.
I guess most likely I will end up going back to the therapy group and maybe, I don't know. I know there's a Lutheran church here, and that seems, you know, more legit than some of the other, you know, Reformed churches where I live in my area. So I maybe will go there. Although I don't know, it seems like they're more keen on acquiring the German audience. But once again, you know, I think if they're Christians, they, you know, don't really have a valid reason, you know, to not let me go.
That's right. That's very true. Oh, and especially if they're a Protestant church in the midst of a lot of Russian Orthodox churches, if they if you start coming there, they get a sense of validation. So,
well, I'll see. Hey, can I ask you? I was wondering something. So you said in your videos that you worked in Dominican Republic.
Yes.
Right. Can I ask you, because, you know, I have a theory that, well, not really a theory, that, you know, in more traditional societies, people treat violence a little bit different. They're much more casual to it. So I don't really know anything at all, really, about the Dominican Republic, but my guess would be that they're more traditional. And I was kind of wondering, Have you encountered physical fights on the street, let's say, when you were there? Or is it like still a rare occurrence there? Because I'm curious.
There was your intuitions about violence, I think, are correct. I think traditional societies are more comfortable with violence than developed societies, if we want to use that word.
Oh, modern societies.
Modern societies. For example, one of the things that you could count on in the Dominican Republic was called a huelga, which is a strike. And one of the things that would happen would be the power company in the Dominican Republic was owned by the state. And what that meant was that in poorer neighborhoods especially, everyone would just run up the power pole and connect up their line directly to the transformer instead of paying the state. And so there's so many people who are getting electricity for free. The state wasn't getting enough money for electricity. And so they would have roving blackouts to try to compensate for the money that they weren't getting. Every now and then, the power company would say, we're going to cut off this whole neighborhood because nobody in this neighborhood is paying. And so they would cut off the power. And then basically what would happen is the neighborhood would go on strike. And what that meant was they would throw tires, they would burn tires in the roads, usually maybe on a major thoroughfare. They would throw rocks at trucks. They would, you know, throw rocks at the police, so on and so forth. And usually the way this drama went is the army would come in and maybe shoot a few people and, you know, kind of put down the revolt. And then the power company would come in and put the power back on and everything would go back to normal. And this kind of thing would not happen in the United States. You know, if someone didn't pay their power bill, it doesn't matter how poor you are, there are programs for the poor and all these kind of things. But when the power company turns off your power, it's off and it won't be on again until you pay. And, you know, your neighborhood isn't going to, if your neighborhood decides it's going to have a big, you know, be upset about something. And so then we get, every now and then you'll get a demonstration or something in the street. People are upset about something. Recently, it was the shooting of a young black man not far from here. But the cops usually wouldn't shoot anybody. They would kind of show up and maybe a little bit of tear gas, maybe, you know, usually not, just kind of show of force and people, but there'd be cameras around. If someone starts throwing rocks and breaking cars, then you get arrested. And, you know, so it's very right that what has happened in, you know, in a developed country like this is violence. Well, the state has a monopoly on violence, and the state enforces that monopoly pretty rigidly. But in a country that the state doesn't really have as much control, like the Dominican Republic, a little bit more violence around. You've got a good point.
Well, it's just, you know, I'm looking around and I think I'm seeing less and less kind of, you know, just fights on the street, you know, two guys kind of fighting each other. When I was younger, I've seen it way more often than I do now. And I think it's because, you know, my country is developing. You know, Russia, you know, do you think that Russia is a totalitarian state or do you think that it's a free?
Well, I would say that the news organizations in America pretty much see Putin as a dictator who fixes his elections so he keeps getting elected. That's what news organizations in the West say about Putin.
Yeah, right. But, you know, there's still a lot of difference between what was in the Soviet times and what it is now. And it's not just, you know, Putin. You can critique Putin here pretty much. Nothing will happen to you unless, you know, there's some very fringe cases where, you know, you're a politician, you want to get into the power. Well, if you critique Putin then you might expect more troubles coming your way. But if you're just a regular citizen, you can critique Putin as much as you want. Nothing will happen to you. So in that sense, the totalitarianism is gone. From Russia, and Russia became much more civil and, you know, more modern, I guess. You know, also we have the free market, obviously, now. But, you know, also the totalitarianism is gone pretty much, you know, from Russia. I think, you know, it's just, I'm observing that, I'm just, very rarely do I see people fight on the streets. But when I was a child, it was much more, you know, much more frequent occurrence. So I'm kind of interested in that because I'm looking at USA and, you know, it goes into another direction a little bit too much where people are so freaked out by violence. Just the mere thought of it, it just makes people frenzy. It's unbelievable. I don't really want that to happen to Russia.
Well, what you just described is very interesting to me. This is a fascinating observation, one that I had never thought of before.
When countries modernize, there's this strange phenomena that, you know, people just, really stop fighting each other. You know, the Fight Club comes to mind, where, you know, why are we not fighting? When was the last time you had yourself in a fight? And it's like, it's not that I haven't, you know, had myself in a fight. I'm just not seeing fights anywhere on the street since I was a child. It's fascinating.
Well, it's very interesting because there was on Twitter, I think I saw it, there was a viral video that went out. Everybody was in a line in some shop, and then some guy is just beating up some girl, the girl comes from behind the counter. She just clocks the dude. I mean, she just levels him. And of course, this went viral. And I was watching it. I was thinking, I wonder where this video comes from. Ah, it comes from Russia. And the the impression in the United States is that there's more violence on the street in Russia than there is in the United States.
No. You know, I'm pretty sure in the USA people, you know, act crazy too. You know, there's crazy clip coming from America too, but those more of fringe cases.
Yeah,
very rare.
Yeah,
you know, to my cousin, I guess, you know, just a little girl and her mother, they were in a shop, and some crazy guy just walked in with a brick and smashed the glasses, and it almost hit, you know, my niece, and, you know, it was horrible, but he was crazy. He was mentally disturbed. There's something wrong with his brain physically, so.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I'm talking about, you know, when I was a child, you know, people would just, you know, two adult males, they would have some disagreement, and they, you know, the threat of physical violence was almost there. You know, they could get into fights, and it wouldn't be seen as something extraordinary. Yeah. But nowadays, it just doesn't happen, especially in my generation.
That threat remains here. People will get into fights, but it doesn't happen that much. And when it does happen, everybody pays attention to it. Yeah. And then the police will get involved. Someone will call the cops. And usually, if you lose the fight, then you'll call the cops.
Obviously, but it's just, you know, I find it, I find it fascinating how much the life has changed in the past 100 years. And it seems to me people don't talk about it enough. The way I see it, people should be, you know, in the universities, they should be taught the history of the world with all of its, you know, nastiness and ugliness, but instead they're making the safe spaces. And it's like, it just doesn't seem right to me. You know, you really need to know how terrible life was for your ancestors to kind of appreciate life of anything.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I'm about out of time, Dimitri. But okay. this has been a delight. This has been a delight for me. I've really enjoyed this. I will send this to you, and you can look at it and decide if you would allow me to post it. I'd be happy to post this.
Okay.
What's that? It's okay if I post it? Okay.
Well,
I really love your delight. You're fun to talk to, and so I really appreciate it. And it's always fun hearing a perspective from another part of the world, because what do I know of Russia? It's only through the media. And I know that's
you don't not really a, have a reason to know.
Well, you know, but with all the Trump stuff and Russia's in the news all the time. And so it's just fun talking to a regular guy, unless you're a Russian agent and you're trying to colonize my channel. And I don't think so.
Well, it's funny that thought came to your head.
Russia's not Russian collaboration with Paul Vanderclay.
They're going to be on FBI list.
That's right. I'm happy we collaborated on this video. So now there's direct evidence of my collaboration with Russia. So
all right.
Say hi to Vlad. Say hi to Vladimir Putin for me. Well, you have a good. You, I don't even know what time. What time is it there?
Oh, it's morning. I believe there is 12-hour difference.
Oh.
Well, it's anyway. It was 6 in the morning for me. It was fine. It was the time I wake up usually.
Wow. Well, you have a good day then.
Thank you.
Take care.
Oh, you too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.